W.J. Burns at Work in Frank Case. The Atlanta Georgian, Wednesday, 18th of February, 1914, 7th edition, final, page 1, column 1. Statement issued by prisoner declares prosecutors have made great mistake, but he is of forgiving mind. Detective W.J. Burns, in Atlanta to lecture, said this afternoon he had been employed to investigate all circumstances of Mary Fagan's death. He will be assisted by Dan Lehan of New Orleans, superintendent of the Southern Burns agencies. I have been engaged merely to see if there are any possible clues that have been overlooked, said Mr. Burns. Leo M. Frank, in his first extended utterance since he was placed in a cell at the Fulton County Tower, Wednesday reiterated his declaration that he knew nothing of the murder of Mary Fagan and asserted that the hand that had written the notes found by her dead body was the same that had wrapped the cord around her neck and strangled her to death. Luther Z. Rosser, chief of counsel for Frank in giving out the statement, said, "How prepared by Frank alone. No human being, so far as I know, suggested anything that is in the statement. Frank had no help. He wished to make a statement to the public, and it was decided that he might do this. His statement was brought to the office just as you see it here, without interlineation and without revision. If it proves an unwise move, he alone is responsible. If it proves wise, no credit is due to his attorneys." Here is Frank's statement in full. By Leo Frank, out of deference to the wishes of my attorneys and respect to the high tribunal which has been considering my case, I have refrained from public expression in the premises. Today, these limitations and restraints do not exist, and I feel free to unbosom myself in the matter, as I have naught to conceal or extenuate. While there rests upon me at this date the shadow of a sinister cloud, I confidently believe that a ray of light will break through this cloud and illuminate this sad affair with truth, and that I will stand vindicated of the dire accusation against me in the eyes of all men. My faith in men is unshaken, my faith in my fellow citizens of Georgia steadfast, my faith in God supreme. Great mistake was made. I can truthfully say that there rests no bitterness or recrimination in my heart against those who, with the authority of the law behind them, have enmeshed me, an innocent man, in the meshes of the law's machinery. I feel that they all have made a great mistake, a mistake which I trust has been unwittingly committed, and the error of which I hope they may soon see. I feel toward them as like the great Nazarene, who said, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." A fabric reared upon a foundation of sand and a case upon a basis of error cannot, and will not, stand the acid test of reason, truth, and fairness. I don't ask for pity, for sympathy, or for quarter. I stake all on the truth. That alone is unshakable, uncrumbling, and lasting. I feel confidently that the truth will out, that God will not let an innocent man suffer for the crime of another, that the truth is on the march. His review of case. Let us pause a while and let the light of common sense pass in review over this case. I know that the rank and file of our citizens are willing to withhold judgment until the last chapter of the Frank case has been written. There is one fact, one undeniable fact connected with this case that lifts it from the realm of mystery and places it in the category of just plain, dastardly, ordinary, brutal murder. I refer to the two notes which were found by the body of little Mary Fagan. Unquestionably, without any gratuitous additions, the person that wrote those two notes killed Mary Fagan. There can be no doubt of that. Nor do I think any fair-minded and just person will doubt it. I wish that every Georgia citizen had a copy of these two notes and could study them for and by himself. I think the light of truth in this lamentable affair would then begin to break through. Writer of Note Slayer. The two notes form a piece of evidence which is in a class by itself. They cannot be twisted or rattled on the witness stand, nor can any amount of third-degree coercion star chamber session or training make them change what they indelibly will always proclaim to the world, that the hand that wrote these two notes tied the cord around poor little Mary Fagan's neck. The study of these notes must show the truth. One cannot dodge it if he undertakes to look at the matter fairly. It is a case of where he who reads may learn the truth. The study of the notes brings up another ridiculous, though sinister, element of the case Jim Conley. I am not going into Conley's story in detail, for the facts concerning him are too well known to the general public for me to dilate upon them. His tale is replete with incongruities and impossibilities. His acts betray him. His acts, even according to his own testimony on the tragic April 26, 1913, are not of a nature to inspire the confidence and belief of the reasonable thinking human beings who aim to do justice. I say with the assurance of my innocence that the truth, the ultimate unchangeable truth that must vindicate me in the eyes of the world, that the simple facts show that Jim Conley's recital is not alone a vicious lie, but was impossible. In the last analysis, the public, seeing clearly through the maze of contending and conflicting emotions, will recognize the truth and cry out for fair play, and decency will be vindicated. Good people of the state of Georgia will never be a party to a judicial murder and stand aloof and watch a man wrongfully done to death. Truth must out, common sense and decency be victorious. Stands by first statement. My statement at the coroner's inquest has never been changed, disproven, or challenged in even a minor detail, and yet I am condemned on Conley's statement, a statement that has been altered and changed to suit each new phase in the working up of the case against me. Detective Scott swore to this on the stand. The lamentable conditions prevailing at my trial were born of excitement and sensation. I feel secure that the great mass of the people will cry out for the full measure of justice to be given me and fair play meted out to me. That is all I ask. More, I do not want. Will ask rehearing. A motion for a rehearing before the Supreme Court of Georgia will be the next move in the desperate battle to save Frank from the gallows. This was indicated after a conference Wednesday between the lawyers who have been fighting in the factory superintendent's behalf only a little less than a year. Mr. Rosser, at the conclusion of the conference, admitted that this was the most likely procedure, but was not willing to say that a definite decision had been reached. Motion will defer sentence. A motion asking for a rehearing will be submitted in writing to the Supreme Court. This will be done probably within a few days, and if granted, will serve to stay the sentence to be pronounced by Judge Ben Hill, and may, in fact, obviate the necessity of a resentencing at this time. In the event that Frank is brought before Judge Hill before any move is made by the defense, he is expected again to receive the death sentence. While some question has arisen as to whether Judge Hill might not sentence Frank to life imprisonment, the judge is known to renew Judge Rowan's original sentence of hanging. Reports from the tower Wednesday morning said that Frank had slept well as usual, and that means very well indeed. His wife's second visit of the fateful day lasted until 10:30 o'clock, after which the prisoner retired. Takes usual exercise. Apart from the unusual number of visitors, Tuesday was spent much as any other day by the prisoner. The barber's visit was on schedule time. He had his hair trimmed, in addition to the daily shave. In the afternoon, he took his dumbbell exercise and calisthenics. A great and abiding faith in his innocence and its ultimate triumph, or a most consummate nerve and impudence, is sustaining the prisoner in a role of fortitude and calmness perhaps without a parallel in the annals of the state. Three courses are open to the accused man, and they are being pondered carefully by him and his attorneys before it shall be decided which card to lead for the final trick in the game. The first plan may be expressed as a motion for a rehearing before the Supreme Court, the same body which handed down an adverse finding on Tuesday, must have new evidence. The second course is what is termed an extraordinary motion for a new trial in the Superior Court, the trial court in the case based on newly discovered evidence. The third plan is an appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States on the ground that the defendant was deprived at his trial of certain constitutional rights. All three of these courses, or any one or two of them, may be invoked. Even if failure was the portion of all, it would be possible to defer the final ending of the case as much as a year, perhaps longer. The second course, as given the foregoing, is not deemed practicable at present. At least, there has been no hint of any new evidence turning up that could warrant the filing of an extraordinary motion. Frank's lawyers are working over the Supreme Court's finding, sifting both the assenting opinion of the four judges and the dissenting opinion of the two in the effort to extract sufficient strength for the case to be presented in the fight for a new trial. It also is understood that the dissenting opinion of Chief Justice Fish and Justice Beck, to the effect that evidence of Frank's relations with women other than Mary Fagan was inadmissible, will be used basically in the next legal battle. Page 2, Column 2. Burns, here flays Blees as barking dog that doesn't bite Mr. and Mrs. W.M.J. Burns, detective, in Atlanta to lecture, says governor would be menace in Senate. Vigorous denunciation of Governor Cole Blees of South Carolina, whom he characterized as a barking dog who doesn't bite, was launched Wednesday by William J. Burns, head of the Burns Detective Agency. The famous detective, accompanied by Mrs. Burns, arrived in Atlanta Wednesday morning from St. Louis and went to the Georgian Terrace. He will speak at the Baptist Tabernacle Wednesday night, under the auspices of the Alcahest Lyceum Bureau. Detective Burns's arraignment of Governor Blees came when a newspaper man asked him if he came through South Carolina en route to Atlanta. "I came from St. Louis," said Mr. Burns. "It seems there is a fellow in South Carolina, what's his name?" "Oh, yes, Blees. Who doesn't like me because I've told the truth about him?" Senate rumor surprises him. "However, that fellow is the least of my worries. He is a barking dog that doesn't bite. He talks and rants and blusters around and yells about what he is going to do and then tucks his tail beneath his legs and runs when you say, boo, at him." Mr. Burns's attention was called to the fact that Governor Blees contemplates entering the race for United States Senator. He expressed his surprise. "I hadn't heard about that," he remarked. "I have understood that for the last few years the people have been trying to clean up the United States Senate instead of besmirching it. To elect that fellow to the Senate would be a disgrace to American citizenship, would represent only himself. I don't think the people of South Carolina have so far deteriorated in intelligence that they will elect a man of that fellow's type to the United States Senate, where many men who have been good men have worked. However, if he should be elected, South Carolina would be in the unique position of having two senators and being represented by one, for that fellow Blees doesn't represent anybody anytime but himself." Mr. Burns refused to discuss the Frank case, on which one of his agents worked for several weeks last summer, on the plea that he knew nothing about it except what he picked up in various portions of the country. But he gave his views on crime and the causes of crime willingly, incidentally taking issue with the men in authority in Georgia who believe that in imprisonment, the idea of punishment should take precedent over the idea of reformation, reform idea paramount. "When a man is imprisoned," he said, "neither the idea of punishment nor the idea of reformation should be lost sight of. Certainly, a man should be punished when he violates the law, but the idea of reformation should come first. We put men in prison in the hope of making better men out of them, and in all imprisonments, the hope of reforming the prisoner should occupy more attention than the desire to punish. The man who says a criminal should be punished rather than reformed has not studied the subject. Mr. Burns scorned the statements of famous criminologists that crime is hereditary. "That theory is foolish," he said. "Just because a boy's father is a criminal, it does not follow that the boy must be a criminal. Heredity has nothing to do with it. Environment causes crime. Environment is a greater cause of crime than ignorance, for our greatest criminals are educated men."